The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here's the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in. Great to have you on board. Apologies up front for my cold. If you hear me coughing or something like that, I'm still kind of stuck with it. Doing the best we can. Fortunately, I didn't get the flu, but I am susceptible to these stupid colds. I remember growing up, we can go to the moon. Why can't we cure the common cold? And you know, here we are, how many years later, and we can't go back to the moon, and we can't cure the common cold either. I guess there's something there. Anyway, we have a great show planned for you today, and I'll introduce our speaker again to you in just a minute, but you can call us, 1-866-687-7223. And again, no call screeners, do let the phone ring, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. If you happen to know that you have call waiting on your line, please disengage it before you give us a call, because it's really nerve-wracking when it starts going off, and we appreciate you on that. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do remember that we are copyrighted and trademarked, but you do have permission to download our shows and pass them around and share them. Please don't do anything commercial. No edits, private YouTube channels, cuts going on your own website, anything like that. And we don't permit written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. We don't have that permission from our guest, and we appreciate your following our simple guidelines. If you do have ideas for a program or something you would like to do, please contact me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Andrew does our podcasting over at gigadial.net. Our RSS URL is on our website, and both of our newsletters, easy for you to subscribe if you want. We can have our podcast over in iTunes, Microsoft Zoom, Podcast Alley, astrospacenow.com, yastro.com, and a host of other places. Then do email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com, if you have any podcasting or, in that fact, other questions, including guest suggestions. Visit our website, and that is thespaceshow.com, so we have our detailed newsletter there. You can't possibly miss it. And it goes up Sunday evening. It has all of the comprehensive details of what our shows are about, our guest bios, and it also is the only place you'll find the future events section for the Space Show. Everything we do is archived. We go back to 2001. We're coming up on our 12th birthday. We're thinking about a special show for our 12th birthday. More about that later on. We have a store on our website. You'll see it up near the top, Space Show Gear. Probably the most important button there is Support the Space Show. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Our program exists because many of you do support us. We thank you very much for your support. It is what's keeping us on the air. And remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a deduction still, because we are a nonprofit, 501c3. And if you happen to pay California taxes, you also get a deduction. We are a California public benefit corporation. So check us out. If you have any questions, do let me hear from you. And just about 1 year ago, January of 2012, we introduced to all of you through the Space Show Dr. Edmund Storms, and so he's back with us almost to the day. 1 year later, he obtained his PhD in radiochemistry from Washington University in St. Louis. He is retired from the Los Alamos National Lab after, I guess it's now, 35 years of service. His work there involved basic research in the field of high-temperature chemistry, as applied to materials used in nuclear power and propulsion reactors, including studies of cold fusion effect. Over 70 reviewed publications and monographs resulted from this work, as well as several books, all describing the assortment of materials. After he retired from the National Lab in 91, he went to Santa Fe, New Mexico. He has his own home and lab there in which he continues to study these subjects. He talks about LENR, and for those of you wanting the simple generic term, I guess cold fusion maybe still works. And there's a lot that's happened in the year, and there's a lot on the agenda for 2013. So it is great to talk to Dr. Storms again and find out all about the updates and the plans. So, Dr. Storms, welcome back to the Space Show. Happy New Year to you. And is 2013 going to be the year for all of this to sort of come together and really start giving us opportunities for going down a commercial development road?
Well, hi, David. It's good to be with you again. The answer to your question is probably yes. We're all very optimistic and hopeful that this great discovery will finally be acknowledged by society in general and the scientific community and be given the necessary financial support to answer some of the very critical questions. I mean, just to give you your listeners a little update in case they came into this idea sort of late, about 24 years ago, two professors at the University of Utah claimed to be able to make significant energy by a fusion reaction in ordinary material. And that claim was pretty much laughed at, and for good reason. I mean, the early claim was pretty outrageous because it violates almost everything we know about nuclear chemistry. And it did not have the support initially. But over the years, over the 24 years, a lot of people have continued working to some extent at their own expense. And the amount of information has grown to a point now where this claim is proven absolutely to be correct. Now, that would not be anything more than a nuisance that is rejected now, except for the fact that this method of producing fusion generates the ideal kind of energy. It produces energy that has no radioactivity, no carbon dioxide, no harmful products. The energy comes from water, which is accessible to everybody, and the generators would be small enough to be in every individual home and supply power no matter what happened in the weather or what happened to the grid. We're presently absolutely desperate for that kind of power for lots of different reasons.
So it sounds to me like the green energy guys would want to put $500 million into this rather than the stuff that goes bankrupt a couple of months later.
You would think so. And the irony is that they don't seem to be all that interested for a number of different reasons. I mean, one is this is a kind of technology that has some flaws. We still don't understand how it works exactly. It's not completely reproducible. It's somewhat difficult to understand unless you have a rather deep background in physics and chemistry. It's not as easy to understand as a solar collector or a wind generator or growing corn to make ethanol. So it has a handicap. But besides that, it is the most ideal energy you could possibly imagine. And there, you would think that because of that, people would take an interest. The very great unhappiness and disgust that I have is that that interest has not developed.
So why do you think that interest doesn't develop? I mean, certainly the reviewed papers and the science is out there to show people the potential.
Well, I think there's two basic reasons. The academics reject it because it simply does not fit their view of nuclear interaction, nuclear chemistry. It requires an explanation that violates a number of tightly held views. And so they are not enthusiastic about going down that road, trying to figure out how it works. We still don't know fully how it works. People are working on that, but nevertheless, it's not satisfactory. That explanation is not satisfactory to the academics. So that there's no enthusiasm in general science, therefore, to support it. On the other hand, if this energy does come about, if it is put into commercial use, it becomes tremendously a threat to the present energy industry. So they're not interested in it. So you don't have a lot of constituents that are fighting for it. The general public, who would benefit enormously, doesn't know about it. And they don't know about it because it is not something that is, the knowledge is not made available to them. You don't hear about it very often on the news. 60 Minutes had a very good program a few years ago describing some successful work. We thought that that might generate some popular following, but it has not. So you don't have a lot of support. And then you have the U.S. government, which is handicapped in all kinds of other ways, and they just simply don't have the attention span to pay to go down this road. There's too many other things.
So where does that leave us, and what happened in 2012 and what's going on in 2013? For example, when we talked last year, there seemed to be a lot of interest in the Italian machine that was starting to be marketed. I'm forgetting the exact name, but CAT or something like that. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, the ECAT by Rossi.
Right. So yeah. That was starting to be marketed, I understand, in Italy. What happened here?
Well, he's still attempting to do that. The process has a lot of flaws in it. It's one of the handicaps in the field that the way in which things are done, because it is such an unusual phenomena, and its application has a potential not only huge income but a disruptive character, one has to be very, very careful. And Rossi has a personality also that is not, what would I call it? It's not the one that would make you trust what he is saying. He has made predictions, and he has had tests made, but there have always been flaws and questions.
Is he a politician?
No, he's not a politician. He's an engineer.
Okay.
By training, and probably a very good engineer, a very smart guy. But he's got a tiger by the tail in two respects. And the one respect is how do you fund this, and how do you get any kind of income from putting this in a commercial environment, because you can't get a patent. I mean, the U.S. will not get patents on this. And furthermore, he doesn't really understand how it works. So he's really handicapped there. And, of course, the other problem is that the system simply does not want to believe this. So he has to fight an uphill battle. And he's doing that. He's working very hard to try to make this work. There's enough uncertainty in people's mind looking at what he's done and his tests to really know whether he has something there or not. My belief is that he has, but it is not reproducible enough, it is not reliable enough to be a commercial product. And he's having to find out how to fix that. And that's been a real problem. It's slowed things down. There are other companies now that are attempting to do the same thing. And they are in different stages of success or demonstration. Sooner or later, somebody will figure this out, put it together in a form that makes commercial sense, and then it'll hit the market. The big question is, will this come from the West, or will this come from China?
And your thoughts on that, where do you think?
My guess is that it will come from China. The Chinese have the skills, they have the people, they have the incentive, and they have the ability of the government to fund pretty much anything they want to. They don't have to quarrel with the system that we have here. They can put something like this together very quickly once they figure out how it works, and they have a program trying to investigate it. They also have no incentive to make that knowledge known. And so my guess is that at some point in the future, we'll suddenly see on the shelves of Walmart a cold fusion generator, and everybody will be surprised, just like they were surprised about Sputnik some years ago.
And you would then be able to put this in your house and generate your own electricity?
Yes. The beauty of cold fusion, unlike hot fusion requires a huge, big machine to function. That's built into the physics. Cold fusion requires a very small machine to function, which is also built into the physics. That small machine could very easily be the size of a small refrigerator, and it would supply your home with heating, electric lights, and your plug-in hybrid with a battery charge for transport. There would be no need for the electric grid at that point. And this device would function for many months. Rossi says that his present system requires upgrade every 6 months, but that will probably be extended. And it will just simply make energy continuously for very little cost.
So I can just see the Public Utilities Commission in California and some of these other organizations and Southern Cal Edison and Pacific Gas and Electric, they would be going out of business. They'd be screaming bloody murder and lobby for protective legislation and everything else, or building codes to put this in your house or office that would make it really unattractive to do it.
That's right. And right now the people in the energy systems are aware of cold fusion. Some of the energy companies have even replicated the effect, and they know it's real. It hasn't reached the point where it's an economic threat. When it becomes an economic threat, and that's all would be obvious to everybody, then precisely what you're talking about will happen. Regulations will be put into place. Various ways will be created legally to slow the process down. That's inevitable. And that's why China doesn't have that problem, and that's why I think the Chinese will implement it in China, and then they will start selling it to the West, and at that point the system will have no choice but to respond, because anybody who has a source of energy will be able to manufacture goods much cheaper than the person who or the company that's using conventional energy. And so the economics will drive the system.
So what has to happen in 2013, or what did happen in 2012, that is leading us closer to this reality?
Well, the information about the reality and information showing how it works is growing. This work is being done all over the world. There are programs in at least 8 countries, including the United States, I might add. And that information is accumulating and reaching a critical mass. And as a result, people are becoming more and more aware that this is real. And the claims by Rossi and the other companies that are proposing a commercial product are becoming known to people in general and to people who have money and to governments. I mean, the Italian government, for example, is officially in favor of this and supports it at government levels. And that's also true in China, and it's partially true in Japan. It's not true in the United States, and it's not true in many other countries. But that support is growing. And gradually it will reach a level where everybody will realize that we have something of importance here, and they'll jump on board. That transition has not quite happened yet, but it's getting close.
You have an email that's already come in from Jock, and Jock is in Newport Beach, California. And Jock says, can a researcher who is a legitimate researcher get an NSF grant to pursue his research on this subject? Why or why not?
No, he cannot, because the government, U.S. government officially, believes that this phenomena is not real. Now, that's, you have to qualify that a little bit. The DOE had two panels that were designed to evaluate the reality of cold fusion. Both of them, and one of them was just a few years ago, said that money should be put in the normal way in order to explore the reality. The most recent panel was more emphatic about that. But the DOE has not implemented that suggestion. There are a few programs in the government funded by particular agencies that are pursuing it for their own self-interest. But in general, you cannot get money by putting in a grant. There's two problems there. One is, right now, grant money is very, very hard to get, and whatever grant is given to somebody coming in from the outside has to be taken from somebody that's already in the system. That's very hard to have happen. And the second thing, of course, is that the government is not enthusiastic about this particular phenomena, and that would also make it very difficult to get grant money. Most of the money has come from private sources.
If 2012 saw research advancements and 2013 continues that, can the government continue to ignore it? I mean, you know, they've got scientists and researchers that pay attention to the literature, what's going on out there. I mean, they're not. How easy is it for them to deny the research and the analysis and the conclusions that are being reported by credible scientists and reviewed literature?
Well, it's, you see, there's two levels to any kind of support in this country. One is rational, based upon evaluation of the reality and the literature, which you're talking about, and the other is political. The two have very little relationship to one another. And right now, the main problem is political. The reality, the knowledge, the facts are easily obtained. They're there. The proof is overwhelming. I mean, it's just, if it were any other subject, it would be supported full bore by the government. Right now, the problem is political.
To those on the outside looking in, you know, we're not engineers or scientists, but we understand what this is. And the politics comes from the fact that it is such a threat to the status quo and to, I guess, to politicians, because the status quo certainly helps them in their campaigns, while I seriously doubt there's any campaign money coming out of the cold fusion industry to support a politician. So I think that's really what you're talking about, right?
That's what I'm talking about. For anything to happen in this country, there has to be two things. There has to be the self-interest of a congressman, or enough congressmen have to be satisfied. And there has to be a constituency in the general public that can put pressure to bear on Congress. Congress will do nothing, essentially, by looking out in the world and say, "Oh, what's best for humanity? What's best for the country?" That's no longer happens, and you can see that over and over again in the way Congress behaves with respect to the financial problems. You know, the idealism that we used to have towards how the U.S. government should work no longer applies. And it particularly does not apply to cold fusion for the very reasons that you just described.
Okay, so I recently, a couple of weeks ago, did a show with my friends from Icarus Interstellar, and Dr. Sonny White was there, and we were talking about the advances in what they're looking at with warp drive. Now, I know this has nothing to do with what we're talking about today. But there is an enormous amount of excitement in the research and the minimizing of the energy that may be needed. And Dr. White is also part of NASA Johnson. And so all of this is coming out, and it's pretty credible stuff. And so what's the equivalent in 2012 that went down with the research on cold fusion, even if it didn't come from within America? Do we have breakthrough studies? Did somebody come up with, you know, the silver bullet or close to the silver bullet? What happened in the year 2012 after you and I talked in January of that year?
Well, it is not possible to point to a silver bullet. And in cold fusion, the basic reality, that the description of how nature behaves, was in place probably by the year 1995. And what's happened since then is we've just added more detailed information, made more measurements of the same kind, but better, answered the skeptics' questions and shown that their particular complaints were invalid. So it's just simply, we had essentially the house constructed. We just furnished it a little better. So there's not anything that you can point to except the claims by Rossi. Now, Rossi came out of left field. He was totally unknown to the field until he made his announcement. That got a lot of people's attention because he was claiming to actually make enough heat that this could be a commercial product. And he was claiming to make it routinely without fail. Those were two things that were missing in the field before then. We did not have a level that could be identified as being commercial, and it was not reproducible. He claimed he had both. That was one of the big things, if you want a silver bullet, that attracted attention. Now, that attention has decayed away because Rossi has not actually proven his claim well enough. He's proven it well enough to certain people, but not to the society in general. And he has not delivered a commercial product. So until he either demonstrates his claim unambiguously or produces a commercial product, we don't have any proof that his claims are real. That's a big problem. Now, there are other people who have come and made similar claims, and they're starting to gain some traction. There's a fellow in Italy, Celani, who has claimed that he has made a wire that produces heat routinely without fail. That's being tested now in various laboratories all over the world. If it turns out that his claim is, in fact, justified, then we'll have another example of a possible commercial path. So these things are slowly happening. They just haven't matured yet.
And for 2013, is it more of the same, or are you seeing a project that really is on the cusp that might be the breakthrough everybody would like?
What's happened right now is that enough critical mass is being generated to possibly make progress fast enough that you could, you know, describe it the way you just described it. And one of the things that's now happened is that a major university in the United States, the University of Missouri, is going to hold the next cold fusion conference. These cold fusion conferences are held all over the world, roughly every year or year and a half. The next one, which is ICCF 18 in the series, is at the University of Missouri in July. That's a major university. It's a major, it'll be a major conference because they have a cold fusion laboratory operating at that university that has produced successful examples of cold fusion. So that will be an attraction for people, not only in government, but also in the financial world, to see if they could get, you know, something out of this, get a foot in the door, start making some progress, because now we have a legitimate, recognized, respected university and professors who are advocating for this idea.
So, not being an engineer or a scientist, it probably is a little bit hard for me to ask the question in the right way, but if you took the bulk of the literature and you sat down to make it commercial and reproducible and to prove it, what exactly is missing? What would be the steps you'd have to go? What would you have to accomplish to fill in the blanks that aren't there yet?
Well, let me describe to you, the answer to that is the theory, the understanding, the explanation of how it works. Ordinary science is based upon an understanding that is communicated to various people through the university system. You go to school, you get an education, you get a degree, and in the process, you get knowledge that everybody understands and can use and can cooperate on using to apply to various phenomena of nature. I mean, that's the way the system works. The problem with cold fusion is that we don't know how it works, and there's no university system to teach people how it works. And so we're working in sort of isolation, each one of us, with our own particular ideas of how it works and how to go about making it work. So my focus now has gone from looking at the observational, you know, the experiment, to looking at theory. And so I'm trying to understand all the various theories that have been proposed and generate one of my own to try to better guide research. Now, the problem with cold fusion is that it occurs in a material. Any phenomenon that occurs in a material is subjected to hundreds of different variables that come into play, that affect what's going on in the material. And unless you understand those variables, it takes you forever to figure out what each variable does and you know, which ones you should avoid, which ones you should magnify. That's what's happened in the past. It's been mostly trial and error. People have tried this, tried that, and gotten results pretty much by accident. That's not the way of creating a successful commercial product. You have to be able to make something work every single time and know how to make it work better. And that knowledge has not been achieved yet.
And by having a better theory or understanding of how this works, that's the path to get to that outcome that you're looking for.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's always certain steps in any kind of discovery. The first is the discovery, and then the proof that the discoverer is telling the truth and that what he's saying actually is real. And then enough information has to be accumulated that you can start making any kind of sense of it, because generally the early information is always in isolation and every little piece seems to have no relationship to any other little piece. But gradually you create enough pieces so that it's like painting by numbers. The shape of what you're painting starts to make sense. And we're at almost at that point now. We have enough pieces to put together that you can start making sense of it. So now the problem is actually doing that, doing it successfully. Well, cold fusion only has a few people who have gone to the trouble of generating theories. What we need are hundreds of people. We need some of the best theoreticians to get involved. Well, they've got a day job. They've got other things to do. They could care less about cold fusion. And so we're handicapped by not having the resources, both, you know, the experimental resources, the money to run machinery and do experiments, but we don't have the intellectual resources available. Those have got to be brought to bear on the field, and hopefully by University of Missouri getting involved, that'll start attracting people from outside to the field who have the skills to get this kind of information and to put it together.
But, you know, typically the people I know who work on projects work on things that at least they have a pretty good fighting chance of seeing success. Nobody wants to work on something that, you know, goes belly up a year or two down the road. That's not a good attraction. So if something were there that at least was a partial or some sort of a commanding success. We talk about this in the commercial space, the entrepreneurial space industry. As soon as one company really shows that they can be very, very successful and profitable in the sort of entrepreneurial commercial space arena, others will find it much easier to follow. I think the same kind of principle applies here. That one breakthrough, that one light bulb needs to be there to attract other people, and that seems to be missing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And to a large extent, it's a chicken and egg problem, which is essentially what you're describing. You have to have a success before you can get the funding to have success. I mean, one of the things about conventional, I mean, let's say, take the space program, for example. The space program is using conventional understanding of physics, of engineering, of chemistry, and applying it in a new and novel way. The people who do that are trained at university, and they know that when they go into the space program or to get that training and go into the space program, they will have a job. The problem with cold fusion is that there is no training. There is no department of cold fusion. There is no way in which a person can get knowledge and then get a job later on. That is not part of the system. And the transition from what we presently have to that ability is a big one. And it's that transition that we have to get over. There's an activation energy. There's a Coulomb barrier, if you want. There is a resistance to the next step that has to be overcome.
And this is the same whether that next step came from Italy or China or who knows where. Any of those countries with that kind of an event could change the game field, correct?
That's right. If let's say China or Italy or any country or even Rossi, if somebody were able to put together a commercial source of energy that could be bought and sold, and because of that, you could buy one and you put it in your own laboratory and you could research it forever and determine precisely whether or not it's making excess energy, whether or not it is in fact doing what the manufacturer claims. And once you discover that that is true, then yes, everything changes.
You mentioned earlier the U.S. won't grant patents on this. Is that because they see this as a perpetual energy machine? Why don't they grant the patent?
Yes. Cold fusion has a myth associated with it, and even the use of the words in a patent will get you unpleasant attention. There have been a few patents granted by the U.S., a few of them because they didn't really understand what they were granting the patent to. And in a few other cases, it's because it was not directly related to energy production. But the big problem is that the system, the U.S. Patent Office and the DOE, and to a large extent, the general scientific profession, does not believe this is possible.
Now, there are other names for this other than cold fusion, and I know, for example, I've tried to get people on from NRL and from NASA and others that are doing, I guess it's low-energy nuclear fusion research, and they won't talk. They won't come on the show. They may give a conference lecture or something like that, but taking calls and being on a freewheeling radio show, they don't want to do it. They say we're not ready to talk about this yet.
Well, that's right. You have to hide under the radar, because once a government agency reveals that it is doing this, then the skeptics, the disbelievers, the anti-new energy constituency comes out of the woodwork and say, hey, wait a minute. you guys are wasting public money. You guys are what's wrong with you? You're doing something that everybody knows is foolish. It doesn't work. Well, that's in this world, that creates a problem for these agencies. Some agencies like DARPA, they fund all kinds of crazy things, and so they don't care. They funded cold fusion for a while. The Navy has put some money in, a small amount, but nevertheless some, because they have a huge self-interest. If they can make this work, then all their ships are floating in the fuel. So there's a tremendous benefit. Of course, NASA has a big incentive to see if this works, because they need this power for space probes. So there are isolated examples in the government where they will follow their own self-interest, but they have to keep it quiet, because if they don't, people will come out of the woodwork and see to it that the program is shut down.
Yeah, it almost sounds like the dark ages of science, doesn't it?
There is a lot of that. I mean, we in the field feel a little bit sympathetic to Galileo.
So what do you have in store for your work for 2013?
The rest of the year I'm going to be spending trying to understand theory, trying to make it make sense in terms of what's known. I mean, I have one advantage, and I've read every paper in the field, and I have access to every one of them through the computer. So I have a database that is better than probably anybody else's. So it's easy for me to find the relationships between what has been reported in the literature, and I'll continue to do that and accept whatever funding I can get from outside sources to help this along. But at the end of the year, if this has not made a breakthrough and I cannot gain any kind of financial support personally, then I'm going to switch to something else. Because, as I say, hitting your head against a stone wall for 24 years is a definition of insanity.
And yet over 24 years, you have really seen this field change on the positive side, correct?
Yes, and that's the irony and the sadness of you see progress at a certain level, but you don't see it being applied at the level that it has to be applied at for this to actually be useful, for it to actually be of any benefit to anybody. And, I mean, the whole idea in working on the field is to do two things: to benefit society, because society obviously needs us desperately, and to benefit oneself. I mean, you'd like to gain some financial reward for this effort. If neither of those happen, then you say, well, okay, done my best. It's up to somebody else to do it, and who knows, it might take another 24 years.
Or never. We're at the halfway point, so listeners, we're going to pause and take about a three-minute break. Your phone calls are welcome, especially in our second segment, rather than just email. 1-866-687-7223. Back in 3 minutes with our guest today, Dr. Storms.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Friday show. Our guest today is Dr. Storm. Doctor, you have a caller on hold, but I did have a Jeremy email from Seattle that asked about the status of Pons and Fleischmann, who originally did this work at Utah. Can you tell us what happened? I mean, I did not know that Fleischmann had passed away, so I think other listeners would want to know this update.
Yes, they worked together in France, at Nice in France, under the sponsorship of Technova, which is a subsidiary of Ternova, the car company. Anyway, that program died a decade ago, and they went their separate ways. Pons pretty much dropped out of the cold fusion field. Fleischmann, on the other hand, continued an interest, but he gradually got old and suffered from various ailments and died last year. So he's no longer participating. We miss him, and it's too bad that he died before the field was fully successful. But his work has been now supported, and so he at least had that satisfaction.
Okay, let's see who our caller is. Good morning, caller. Who are you, please?
Hi, my name is Ricardo.
Hi, Ricardo.
And I have a question for Dr. Storms. First of all, I'd just like to make a comment. Dr. Storms, there are many people like myself who you probably have never heard of, but greatly respectful of the work that you've done in this field, and you are one of the few people that we know of who is published in the mainstream scientific publishing arena, and that has made a difference. At least there are published papers that we can point to, and many of them, or some of them, are yours, that it's pretty hard to refute what you have documented in some of your published papers. But to move on to a question, are you aware that the European Patent Office issued a patent today to Ian Telly for his LENR work?
Yes, I saw that. I knew that he had put one in. He had an earlier one. This is a more recent one. Yes, and in fact, as the European Union and Italy have granted a number of patents in the field. Patents are not so hard to get there.
It just seemed to me that we had not seen a recognition of specifically the cold fusion process or low energy nuclear reactions being granted a patent for generating energy. You may know of ones that I'm not aware of. I know that Piantelli filed a couple of earlier patents that had disappeared, but this latest one has been granted, and it's pretty broad. It seems to at least acknowledge in the European Union that this is a real science, that you can reproduce this.
Piantelli's work is one of the serious examples of energy being produced in the light hydrogen nickel system. His work has been published in really good journals for many, many years. It's very well done, and he really he deserves a patent. It was on the basis of those claims that Rossi then amplified the effect using powdered nickel rather than solid nickel. And Rossi has a patent on that variation that has been granted in the European Union, I understand. So, yes, this is good. This is going in the right direction. Italy has been very sympathetic to the effect. The necessary money and resources have been given to people in the field. And so progress is being made there.
And as you pointed out, there's also progress being made in the States and in the public arena via the University of Missouri's research and funding now from independent financier. Do you think that that kind of approach is going to be the key to turn the young minds on? Because what I heard you saying earlier is that we don't have access to the intellectual, the gray matter that is necessary to really dig into theory, especially.
Well, yes. And the work at the University of Missouri is very, very important, not only to advance the field politically, but also they have been doing work understanding the nature of the cold fusion and have been successful. This company, Energetics, came from Israel, set up housekeeping at the university, and set up a program there to study their particular version. That work is ongoing, even though the company went back to Israel recently. They left behind money and some people and a lot of the equipment. So that work will continue at the university and will attract students and faculty to the subject. And that will provide sort of a focal point, a germ, a seed, to get the idea started and moving into the larger scientific profession.
And my understanding is, too, that the University of Missouri is the point of gathering for the next international conference on the cold matter, cold fusion, ICTF, in next summer.
That's right.
So having that conference on the grounds of a university is a step for this country, certainly. And it might further heighten the appearance of cold fusion as a real academic topic for students entering the engineering and sciences field.
Well, that's right. And these conferences more and more are considered to be focal points to get enthusiasm directed towards the field. The one before this was in South Korea. They held it there because they want to start a program about the subject in their university system and hopefully make it commercial. The one before that was in India, and it was done there for the same reason. So these conferences are acting as seeds to focus attention to the field and hopefully generate enough attention that it grows and matures into a useful program.
Well, there have been the other ICTFs, and I've noted that there have been speakers, albeit at the fringe, but at the National Atomic Society or the Atomic National Society. There have been speakers there. I think the Japanese transmutation scientist appeared there recently, a couple months ago, at the American Nuclear Society. That's it.
Yes.
Also, there was a conference at CERN in the summer or spring of last year. It seems that a lot of these mini conferences are gaining attention. I know Dr. Hagelstein does work at MIT and puts on a conference regularly, and I think it's about to start this next week or so at MIT.
Yes, there was a cloakroom at MIT that they've held these sort of regularly. Various societies, American Physical Society and American Chemical Society have had sessions on the subject periodically. You mentioned the American Nuclear Society. That's a recent addition to that list. There are a number of conferences now planned in Europe, and I think there's one in England. But the word's getting out. People are becoming more and more aware, and these conferences are a focal point for getting that information to more and more people.
Right. Well, that all seems great progress to me, and I hate to hear you say that you're about to drop out. But I certainly can understand it. After 23 years of frustration, it makes sense that you would want to hang up your seat. I could certainly sympathize with that. But I hope that you don't, because you've been a great motivator for many people in the pursuit of this this technology, and I think the sense is that I feel from the few people that I know that due to you and the other pioneers who have been working for 23 years, we're right at the cusp of a pretty big either announcement or some kind of general disclosure and acceptance by the mainstream, which would turn a lot of things around.
Well, I appreciate your support there, and I hope that I don't have to cash it in. I'm not looking forward to that. This has been a lot of fun for me, but at some point you sort of have to say, okay, you have to draw a line. And one of the reasons for my drawing the line is that I anticipate a serious economic collapse this year, and I have to spend my time dealing with that, you know, from a personal financial point of view. And if nothing's coming in from the outside, I've got to generate it in-house.
Right. Right. Well, you'd be surprised at how things turn around when you least expect them.
I hope that's the case.
I'll leave it at that. It's a mystery, Dr. Storms. But thanks again very much for all of your...
Well, thank you for your comments.
Thanks for your call, Ricardo. Maybe you need, instead of a cold fusion energy machine in house, maybe we all need some sort of a printing press, right, that works for money, that is legitimate, or you know, lead into gold or something like that.
Yeah.
Lead into platinum. Maybe you can create that. That would be one way to solve our pending economic crisis.
If I could manage that, then all my problems would be over. It would just create other problems for other people.
We'll leave it at that. When you were at Los Alamos Lab, did you work on cold fusion?
Yes. I was working there when Pons and Fleischmann made their announcement, and the laboratory was very, very interested in their claims. I mean, it was absolutely amazing because people just simply dropped everything they were doing and tried to replicate, tried to figure out what was going on. There was a tremendous interest within the laboratory, and I was part of that. And I was successful in replicating tritium production and then later replicating heat production before I retired.
Is the lab still interested in it?
No. No, the laboratory essentially runs under the philosophy of the DOE. And it's increasingly based upon certain requirements of the weapons program. It's not interested in cold fusion.
How does what actually has to happen for cold fusion to work? What is the process? Technically is going on to create the energy?
Well, the energy is created by fusion between the isotopes of hydrogen. Hydrogen has three isotopes: ordinary hydrogen, which is a protium, which is a single proton, and that's the ordinary hydrogen that you in water. The other isotope, which is naturally occurring, is called deuterium, and that's a proton with a neutron stuck to it. And that's also in water that you drink, at about 6,000 parts per million. And then there's the radioactive isotope tritium, which has a proton and two neutrons, and that can only be made artificially, and it's not natural. The isotopes that are used in the cold fusion reaction are the protium and the deuterium. And it depends which one you use as to what product you get. If you use deuterium, you get helium. The two deuterons fuse together to make helium. Ordinary, you know, party balloon gas. If you have hydrogen, the protons, they fuse together, I believe, to make deuterium. Now, that hasn't been proven. And the people who have used light hydrogen have claimed that their energy is coming from what's called transmutation. Now, transmutation is when a hydrogen nuclei goes into the nuclei of a much bigger nucleus or element. For example, they're proposing that a proton goes into the nucleus of nickel to make copper. I don't believe that's possible. I don't believe it happens, but that's my personal belief, but their belief is that it does. But anyway, that's the kind of reaction that is being looked at and potentially is a source of the energy. The major energy, however, which is unambiguous, is the fusion of two deuterons to make helium.
And that's pretty crystal clear in the research, right?
That is absolutely crystal clear in the research. Now, that when you do that, you also can make a little tritium. And I believe I understand how that's made. But tritium, again, cannot be made by any chemical reaction. It's not naturally occurring. It has to be from a nuclear process. And when you see it form in this kind of environment, you know that you've initiated a nuclear reaction. You never make enough tritium to make significant heat, and you never make enough tritium for it to be dangerous, but you make enough tritium to demonstrate that, in fact, a very strange and unusual reaction, nuclear reaction, has in fact happened under conditions where it should not happen.
So when you run up against criticism and it's on the scientific side, What do they say? Do they say you can't fuse these atoms? Do they say it's not making this or that? Where does the criticism come in?
Well, early on, it came because people were familiar with and had studied what's called hot fusion. Hot fusion is essentially the same kind of reactions, but generated by forcing the nuclei to come together at very high energy. In other words, between each nuclei, there's a what's called a Coulomb barrier. All nuclei have a positive charge, and when two positive charges come close together, they repel each other. So you have to somehow or another get over that barrier. You have to push them together hard enough that you can overcome that repulsion. Hot fusion does that. Hot fusion does it at using very, very high energy, very, very high temperatures in a plasma. The result of that reaction is well known, and it produces two paths. One path makes neutrons, and the other path makes tritium, both of which you can easily detect. The cold fusion reaction did not make that. So they would say, okay, we know how a fusion reaction works. It must make neutrons and tritium in equal amount. You're not making neutrons and tritium in equal amount, so therefore you're not producing fusion. Well, we discovered that that logic was flawed. We were, in fact, producing fusion, but by an entirely different process. So then they say, well, okay, maybe that's true, but we don't believe the energy that you've measured. We don't think that you've really measured any excess energy. Well, we did that over and over again, increasing accuracy, so that's off the table. And then they said, well, you're not making helium. Helium's hard to detect. You're making only a little bit of it, you're claiming, and it's not really helium. Well, a number of people repeated that measurement. Yes, it is, in fact, helium. Well, you're not making tritium. Tritium came from contamination. I mean, this was all these studies were all made in laboratories where tritium was available, was present for other purposes, and some of it accidentally got into your device. Well, people did it in total isolation, in places where there was no tritium, in sealed systems. And in my case, I showed that if, in fact, you put tritium in it on purpose, you did not get the behavior that you saw when you made it by the cold fusion technique. So nothing matched. So we could say, no, the tritium is being produced in that cell, and it is not contamination. Well, then the skeptics essentially go into hiding. and then you ask for money, or you get some money, or you propose a patent, and then they come out of hiding and say, hey, wait a minute, you're not allowed to do that. This is all crap. And people get scared, and the money's withdrawn, the patent's withdrawn, and you can't do anything. So a lot of the reaction right now is under the table. It is not direct.
When we did the show last time, first of all, I had a little bit more time to promote the program and your being a guest. But then after the program, I mean, the quantity of emails and the support and the flow of additional information and ideas and even suggesting different guests to elaborate or take the discussion even further was pretty heavy. I mean, it was one of the heaviest trafficked programs before and after the interview that I did in 2012. There seems to be a huge level of support from people who, at least in their emails to me, really knew what they were talking about, many of which signed them with PhD credentials at various different labs or institutions, and many just really informed advocates, I guess, would be the answer to say. I would say it was one of the top two or three supported programs I ever did last year. So there's no shortage out there of people who understand what you're doing and what others are doing and Rossi is doing and potentials. I mean, they may not all see eye to eye. You know, I'm sure there's always disagreements within the discipline, but the general overall support and desire to see this go forward and somehow become far more mainstream appears to be really, really strong, but that it's not strong enough to overcome the status quo of how things, you know, work in the days of funding and tight budgets and academia and government projects and who gets the attention, you know. Do you know what I mean? I mean, people who get the attention often don't deserve it, but it seems to be the path of least resistance to nowhere.
Well, I'm encouraged that you had this response. That's very good to hear. I mean, you know, working in the field, you don't often have that kind of information. You don't see it happening, and you had an opportunity to see just how big the response is, and that's very, very encouraging. And I would only ask those same people to contact other people, to contact congressmen, to contact people in, if they happen to work in a company, for example, that might either benefit from or have the ability to study cold fusion, to encourage that to happen. I mean, we need these people to be spokespersons for and to advocate the idea. That's the only way things happen. You get a big enough number of people who believe what you're doing that they create a critical mass, and then it starts to grow.
You know, I know from the space arena that when guests come on and, you know, everyone says, what can I do to help? You know, that kind of question. And they say, right, you're congressman. You know, there's this big gasp out there because people really do feel disconnected from Congress, and it's a big waste of time to try to waste. And they've all had experiences writing to congressmen on this or that. It just doesn't seem like an effective way to help move really important things forward in our country. I mean, maybe it is, and maybe some people have great success with it. But, I mean, I should publish some of the letters I get when I write Senator Feinstein or Senator Boxer about, not about space things necessarily, but about health care or other issues in the country. I mean, you wouldn't believe the boilerplate letters that I get. I can't believe I'm the only guy getting this crap out there.
No, you're absolutely right. I've gone down that road. Congress is essentially brain dead when it comes to interacting effectively with individuals. What they interact with are groups of people, blocks, organizations that can supply money. They're very sensitive to their own self-interest, and that's very, very clear. When I say write to your congressman, the only time that would have any benefit at all if the number of letters that they get. Forget about what was said in the letters. The number of letters suddenly got big enough that they say, hey, wait a minute, there's a constituency out there. There's an interest out there. Maybe we better pay attention. That would be the one thing. The other is, if the individual who happens to believe this knows the congressman, is a personal friend of the congressman, or is a donor to the congressman who has some influence over the congressman's thinking, those are the people who really do count, and you don't know how many of them are out there.
No, you really don't. I'll tell you what I have found to be at least marginally effective through the space community, and that is that the many, many space advocate organizations, and this is not, I don't find this to be true in LENR or Cold Fusion or whatever, but they have these Space Day in Sacramento or Pro Space goes to Washington, D.C. in groups of people that are part of these organizations, the NSS, the AIAA, from all over the country, and they go in groups to go to this or this congressman or this staffer to talk about space policy, space education, and they get an earring because there's five or six people meeting with maybe 20 members of Congress in a given day or 30 members of Congress, and they give them printed material about the space industry or what's happening in Nevada or California. That kind of interaction with the congressional office seems to have an impact, especially if you can launch the effort consistently year after year. But I don't see that in this discipline.
You're right. You're absolutely right. That's the way you have to do it. That can be very effective. However, that takes money.
Right.
That takes time of individuals who have the skill and incentive to do those things. Unfortunately, the cold fusion field doesn't have that. I mean, we're a bunch of scientists who, generally speaking, have had no political training whatsoever, and we're doing it on our own nickel. To a large degree. So it's very difficult to organize that kind of response.
I don't see so many advocate organizations, like I'm a member of, 10 different space organizations, Space Frontier, Planetary, National Space, AIAA, all of this stuff. I don't see my options for that in this discipline. So while the science is going on, somehow the enthusiast advocacy organization community has to develop to go along to help become a supporting base for it. And I haven't seen that happen yet.
I agree with you. And it's strange that it hasn't happened. I mean, one of the things that I see repeatedly is the various environmental groups and groups that are focused on global warming, the consequences of global warming, being very worried about having essentially things go downhill if we continue to use the same kind of energy, and then fighting to, say, get rid of coal or whatever. It's a losing battle. You're not going to get rid of coal. You're not going to get rid of oil unless there's something to replace it. There is absolutely no way society can get rid of those energy sources, because to do so, you have to turn the lights out. The economies would go downhill because they run on energy. You have to have an energy source to take the place of whatever you remove. And cold fusion promises to do that, but the frustration is that these people don't realize that. they don't say, okay, maybe if we jump into cold fusion, even though it is controversial, maybe we can solve our problems, which are just as controversial as the one as cold fusion.
Yeah, they're not there yet. You have an email, speaking of Nevada, from Las Vegas, from Charles Pooley. Why no neutrons or gamma rays? Either are easy to detect. 1 microwatt of D plus D will produce about 1 million neutrons per second. Charles Pooley.
Yes, that's true if it's done, if that process is done by hot fusion. That is the typical hot fusion reaction product. Neutrons and tritium, the two equal amount because they come from two parallel reaction paths. That kind of consequence of fusion only occurs when you have hot fusion. When you have cold fusion, it goes by an entirely different process. That process does not produce neutrons. That's been demonstrated over and over again, and the number of theories have explained how you can do it without producing neutrons. It's just simply a fact of observation. No neutrons were made, yet people make heat and they make helium.
And this, of course, makes it harder to believe.
Yeah, if you try to insist that the process has to follow the rules of hot fusion, absolutely. It's impossible, played by those rules. But obviously, once you believe that cold fusion is real, and that the heat's real, and that the helium's real, and the tritium's real, all of a sudden you've got a problem. How do you explain it? Because it cannot be explained by hot fusion, but yet the observations are real. So you've got to start looking for a different explanation.
And that's what you're working on for 2013.
Right.
Are you a sole practitioner? Do you work with others? How do you do your own work? I know you do have your own lab. We've talked about that before. Do you have lab assistants? Can you describe your situation a little bit?
Well, I'm a one-man band.
Okay.
I have access to all of the literature in the field, so if I want to understand what's been discovered, it's very easy for me. I have access to the individuals who have made those measurements, so if I want to talk to them, I can. So from a theoretical, from the point of view of trying to develop theory, I have the tools. All you need is a computer and access to the literature. The experimental work, on the other hand, is more of a problem. I do have a small laboratory. I do have equipment that can make heat measurements and radiation measurements. I can detect helium. I can do all those things, and it's a pretty nice laboratory because I have a scanning electron microscope with EDX capability, which is pretty unusual for somebody working in a private laboratory. But nevertheless, the number of variables that you have to take into account are so large that you have to run hundreds of experiments in order to map out what's called the parameter space. That takes more than just one piece of equipment and two hands. So that aspect of my work is very inefficient. And I have had success on periodically, but then you try to replicate that success, and it doesn't work. Well, why doesn't it work? Well, you have two choices. You either can continue to try to match what you did before, which is very, very difficult given all the variables that are involved, or you can sit down and try to figure out how it works so that you can predict what you have to change to make it work. I've decided that's the better road right now.
You have another email. This is Bob is in Cincinnati, and he says, at one time, I think, when I was looking into cold fusion, it seemed to be based upon where one might be geographically located with latitude and longitude. Am I remembering something that is accurate, or is my memory clouded?
No, early in the field, the skeptics like to point that out as being evidence for this being purely a random process, having no reality. Somebody even made the correlation with the success of the football teams of the universities that were advocating this. There are other people who have tried to relate it to the phases of the moon. None of these have been successful. The work has been done now so often in so many laboratories all over the world. It's very clear that it has no correlation whatsoever to where the work is done, to the time of day, to the phase of the moon, or anything other than the fact that we are looking at a real phenomenon of nature that is very difficult to reproduce, to replicate. I mean, I can make an analogy. Early, when the idea of a transistor came about in theory, people applied that, and they discovered that this was, in fact, a phenomenon of nature. The transistor was something that could be made to occur in nature. But to make it work on a reliable basis was very, very difficult. And so they would make 1,000 or 100 transistors, and maybe 2 or 3 of them would work, and they could sell those, but they had to throw away the rest, and they had no idea why the ones did some work and some did not work. It took over $1 billion to figure out the important variable that made some work and some not work. We don't have that $1 billion yet. That has not been applied to this field yet.
$1 billion of work to figure out how the transistor worked.
To figure out what made it not work. What made it not work was a few parts per billion of sodium in the silicon. And then once they figured that out, and that's why they have to use these super clean rooms, even the slightest little bit of impurity will stop the process from working. And once they figured that out and started applying and developing ways of working at the nano level, which now is just absolutely amazing, they could do things with just a few atoms. And once they figured out how to do that, then the whole transistor industry and its application to computers blossomed. But that could not happen until the basic problem of reproducibility was solved. We have that problem, and it has not yet been solved. When it is solved, then the same amplification of this effect will occur.
So finding out why it doesn't work is as important or more important than finding out what you have to do to make it work. It seems like they're the opposite ends of the same coin.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You have to know both. We know a few things about how to make it work, but then when you make it work, you can't keep it working, and you can't do the same thing again and have it work. So you have to know what's stopping it from working just as hard, just as well as you know what you can do to make it work.
How, if you were rating optimism for great progress in 2013, 1 to 10, with 10 being wonderful, given that we're in the middle of January, how would you assess your view of 2013 so far?
Well, I have tremendous optimism. We have gotten almost to the critical mass and almost to the critical tipping point in politics. The only problem is that while that has occurred, the economic crash is underway, which will get even worse. And so that denies money, interest, and attention to what is growing in the cold fusion field. So we have two processes that are working against each other. Cold fusion is growing in its reality to many people, but the ability to do anything about it is slowly disappearing because of the economic situation.
Now, I find this really interesting, and my discussion with you is really reminds me of discussions I have with my space guest on, because my background is finance, business, and economics, marketing, all of that stuff. I'm not an engineer or a scientist. And when I have the space guest on the show, and they're talking about all these grandiose programs and hardware things and stuff that they're going to do. You know, they're going to go to EML-1 or EML-2 or the Lunar Far Side, or we're going to do the asteroid mission or lasso an asteroid, or we're going to the moon in 7 years commercially, or we're going to Mars and whatever. I mean, the list of projects out there is endless, endless, endless. And the one thing I sort of always bring to everyone's attention is you're not connecting the dots to the U.S. as well as global economic problems. How do you see that impacting your plans? And, you know, maybe one out of 20 will see that there is a risk to their plans based upon what's happening economically. They seem to think that even if there are cuts to NASA, it won't hurt very much and everything will be okay. And they seem to think that capital acquisition in the private sector will remain strong because there's so much private capital out there on the sidelines that's just ready for investment once things kind of stabilize and all the bickering in Congress stops. So the ability to connect all of these grandiose plans and events to the risk of our domestic and global economic problems is really missing. And yet here you come on and you connect it. You sound like me with my economics background. So what's special, how do you see the connection economically to your field of research?
Well, I mean, first of all, everybody lives in what we call an optimistic bubble. I mean, you almost have to, otherwise you know, your life would be hell. If you really know what's going on in the world, especially these days, the more you know, the more depressed you get.
Yeah, you better off being an ignorant person or something on the current events or something.
That's right. An optimistic bubble pays off these days. However, it does not pay off if you make decisions based upon that optimism that have no reality. And that's, I'm trying to avoid that. And one of the things that you have to hope for is that there's a, what would I call it? A way around, a
workaround.
A hidden passage through this process. And there are always those. I mean, even under the worst economic times, money is available and money is applied to certain things. I mean, back in the early days, the Eisenhower administration, we were in a depression. They put money into the national road system. Huge amounts of money, very effective. It was absolutely the right thing to do. It could very well be in the coming years the government will say, look, we don't have any money to feed people, we don't have any money to go into space, but we really do have to put some money into solving our energy problems. And in which case, money will be put into cold fusion. I just don't count on that. I don't count on Congress being that rational. You know, I have to plan my life around that not happening. But if it happens, I'll be able to respond instantly.
And in the meantime, you're clearly not having your head in the sand or in the stars, I guess, in terms of this optimistic bubble of continuing on with fields that are of great interest to you. You're looking elsewhere.
That's right. One of the beauties of the Internet, one of the beauties of the communication system that exists now is that people have access to information that was otherwise not available, and they have it's available instantaneously now. So you can follow events that's happening in the world very closely, very accurately, which was not possible a few years ago. If you take the time and trouble to do that, then you can see where life is heading. You can see what the future is going to be. Not 100%, but you can see it much better than if you just sat home and paid no attention. And I make an effort to pay attention.
Well, it would be really terrific if we could see 2013 be a year of great progress or a breakthrough or something, or with Rossi and his work or some of the other people. Are you in touch with Rossi?
No. No, I haven't. A partner of mine has interacted with him, but I have not personally. There's no reason to. He knows about my work. I know about his work. I don't believe his explanation. He doesn't believe my explanation. So it's not exactly something that we can share.
Interesting. What should I have asked you about, since we're at the end of our 90 minutes, what should I have asked you about that I've forgotten or we've omitted or that you would still like to share with us and talk to us about?
Well, if somebody wants to know about cold fusion, the place to get that information is two places. The one is the Internet, and there's a website called www.lenr, standing for Low Energy Nuclear Reaction, .org. If you go there, you will have access to thousands of papers, many in full text. You have access to reviews. You have reviews that start at the high scientific level and go down to the ordinary person level. There's a book available there by Jed Rothwell that talks in terms of ordinary language and tells about cold fusion and how it will work and its impact. There's just a huge amount of information there. If you're technically inclined and you want to know what is technically known, buy my book, which you can buy from Amazon. So I would suggest anybody that's interested in the field, take the effort to find out what's going on, and all the information is available.
Well, I hope that when we talk again in the future, you're still in the cold fusion world and you haven't gone off into some other field.
Well, I hope so, too. So.
And I guess we'll find out in about 11 or 12 months, right?
That's right. Call me back in a year and we'll check base again.
Okay, and in the meantime, if the silver bullet shows up, send me an email and we'll get a show going again right away to talk about it. Or if we're close to a silver bullet or a brass ring or something shows up, we're ready to pounce on the story and talk with you about it.
Okay, well, after the conference at the University of Missouri, there will probably be announcements and insights that will come of that that might qualify as a silver bullet. So let's keep our eyes open on that one.
Is there a way to follow PR announcements in the industry? Does that website, for example, have a newsletter that we can subscribe to or something like that?
Yes, if you go on the Internet on Google search and just type in ICCF18, you'll get a link to the University of Missouri website devoted to that. And on that, there will be a lot of information that will grow over time.
Okay. Then we'll look forward to talking to you in January 2014 or sooner, based on what comes out of Missouri and your theories and other people's fine work. And
great. I enjoyed it, David.
Thank you, Ed, and have a good, productive year, and change the world. Go knock them dead, okay?
Okay, well, you too. You're doing your part.
Thank you very much, sir. Have a good year. And listeners, back with Jim Muncy on space on Sunday on our Space Show program. Goodbye from Dr. Ed Storms and myself. Everyone have a great weekend.